presentation. I live in Australia, and I've lived in Australia for 25 years now. I haven't been back to Scotland much at all in that time, but as I get older, I start to get very homesick for my roots and Scotland and the mountains and all those things, so I kind of glorify Scotland a bit. And I'm just going to start off with a poem which talks a bit about that. This is a kind of gentle poem to open up with, and then things will get a little bit less gentle. There is no sound when it snows, like when you pull your tam o'shanter down over your ears, and I know this muffled silence so well. It is there always in the forest at the end of our road, where conifer boughs layered with thick snow sway like fat babies just fed, their heads lolling on the brink of nodding off. And the train to London whizzes past this forest twice a day, punctuating the silence with two giant exclamation marks, triggering tremors, causing snow to loosen and waltz from boughs with a whispering swoosh. And there were times I was on that train. Mum would drop me at the station in the village, then race back through the forest to wave as my train sped past. And as the forest approached, I'd wave through the window. Though the train went so fast, I could never quite see her, but I knew she was there. The air is iced and sharp here, and I breathe it willingly. Stick my tongue in the air, catch snowflakes that flit. I swallow their flesh, drink down their blood, till I am the snowflake. The snowflake is me. I lived here once, in this icy silence. The place I live now is hot, and there are days I could weep for the boughs of my forest and the north wind that gusts and near blows the Toorey off my Glengarry. This hot place I live is Australia. The land is dry and cracked here, much like the skin on the heels of my feet that were never like that when I lived in Scotland. I've got my father's feet, they say. Heels that need softening in the bath for a fortnight before you could even begin to take the cheese grater to them. And only then will the thick skin come away, crumbly like the mature Scottish cheddar I've never enough money to buy in the supermarket. Things have changed since I came to this hot place. I've forgotten a lot about Scotland, sure that's what I came here for in the first place, but I have my reminders all around me now. Indeed, as I lay here on my bed on this hot January afternoon, wilting from the searing heat and not a breath of air to be had, my dog-eared copy of Antonia Fraser's Mary Queen of Scots jams my sash window open. Since the cord of the sash snapped and sent the uppercase hurtling to the sill like the guillotines that have taken the French heads off more people than I care to remember. And I have my postcard on the wall, the one of the Highland cow my brother sent me from his camping trip on the Isle of Skye. Come back, Ali, it reads, before you forget how good this air truly tastes. Thank you. Sorry. So I did come back, but the reason I was running away to Australia was to get away from my horrible father, who was quite a horrific character. And I came back a few years ago to visit my mum, who had been really unwell. And by the time I got to Scotland, Mum had made a miraculous recovery, and she had separated from my father a few years previously, so I thought I'll swing by and see him. And he was gravely ill, and he died 9 days later. So this poem is going to talk about his last day, really, and the events of the last day of his life. And I would go to the hospital in the afternoons and sit with him until the end of the visiting time. But in the mornings, I would go and try to distract myself from the horror of sitting by the bedside of this man who you sort of love and hate at the same time. The time it takes to boil an egg. The last taste in your mouth would have been that of terror, as strangers in white coats and non-slip shoes punched you hard in the fucking chest, while I wandered the house of Fraser, smearing creamy tracks of hot plum and shocking coral on the thin underside of my forearm at the counter with the French-sounding name. And when my phone rang, I heard the words all right, as though Florence Nightingale herself had said them. And I raced like some kind of lipstick-coated crazy fuckwit from the house of Fraser to the car I cannot find in the car park I am sure I have parked in. Excuse me. And I queue the excruciating 12 seconds for the man in front to pay. I smash my credit card in the slot, insert my ticket at the boom, am urged by electronic ticker tape to please drive carefully and have a nice day. Please fucking spare me the cliches. As I race down the antiseptic hall, pass the hand sanitizer, cover your mouth when coughing, and have you had your flu shot this year? I hurtle towards the nursing station with its limp carnations and male nurse Kevin, plastic aproned, stewing tea and arranging supermarket custard creams for the 3 o'clock highlight. Okay, so you called him a poof that time. Still, he took your vitals, checked your stools, updated your charts, and points now on my arrival to the side room where you have lain since they got you breathing again, so we could be with you when you died for the second time today. Once you were gone, male nurse Kevin shat out insincerities from the section of the manual, suggested phrases on the passing of loved ones, each one thin and worn as the elbows of an Oxfam sweater. And I don't doubt it must be hard to know what to say, Kevin. But no, it wasn't as if he held off dying till I got there. As if my father could perfectly estimate the time it would take for me to get from the house of Fraser to find the car in the car park I am sure I have parked in. As if my father was somehow able to factor in that I would join the motorway in the wrong direction and go speeding north when I should have gone speeding south. As if he could have timed so precisely the traffic jam on the Kingston Bridge, let alone the parking nightmare that is Wishaw Hospital at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday when all the outpatients are in. You'll trust me, won't you, Kevin? When I tell you, I am not interested in your cliches, nor your supermarket custard creams fanned out to look fancy on the plate. My father died, Kevin, 47 minutes after I arrived, and for every beat in the metronome of his slowing song, I counted his breaths in and fucking out, watched his Adam's apple rise and fall, held his hand, swallowed salt, silently screamed as entire cows and roofs and hairy dogs called Toto blustered through the eye of my internal shitstorm. If Kevin, my father truly was waiting till I got there, then surely he would have died, say 60 or 90 seconds after my arrival, or in the time it takes to boil an egg, say 4 minutes tops, 2 if you want to dip soldiers in it. Thank you. Sydney, and a few years ago, when the Syrian refugee crisis was seemed to be at its worst, and Germany took 1 million refugees overnight, the Australian government made a big announcement that they were going to take 1,000 refugees, and they were beating their chests about this as if this was such a great thing for a country with so much wealth. We only took 12,000 of those refugees, and it took 2.5 years to settle 37 of them. And the remaining, I know, the remaining came. Anyway, this was a conversation I overheard in an art gallery in Sydney at that time. So Mia Council Casa is to Council Casa. I live out of Sydney these days. It is close to the beach, though we are not wealthy. Some days there are whales, other days dolphins, occasional jellyfish, and never dead babies. I like visiting the art gallery in the city. It takes me 1 hour to drive there. I park at the expensive multi-story. It is a $10 flat rate on a Sunday. After parking, I cut through Hyde Park, past the statue of Robert Burns, standing alone and too far away from Scotland. We are both foreigners here, of the acceptable kind. I like the location of the gift shop. It is right next to the entry, which is also the exit. I always go to the gift shop first. They have handbags made of unshaved cow, and earrings like hot air balloons, and a dimly lit section at the back with mysterious art books in thick polythene covers. The thickness of the polythene indicates their seriousness and the price, and there is an arsehole in there wearing Jesus sandals, though he bears no resemblance to Jesus, and the arsehole says to a random woman, who turns out to be an arsehole too, he took a holiday in Paris once, on the left bank, some 30 years back when it really was something, and if Hitler were alive today, this whole thing with the Syrian refugees would not be happening. And the female arsehole agrees. Then the Jesus-sandaled arsehole says what's going on over there is nothing but a European invasion, and the subject of the little boy's body on Bodrum Beach comes up. And I have been there on holidays some 30 years back when it really was something. The hotel was right next to the doctor's surgery. Bent black-clad women came daily, clacked rosary beads on milk crates in full view of fat tourists bathing topless on hotel lounges, ordering chips and cokes they did not need from Kadir, the Turkish waiter who brought me proper chai in a glass and taught me how to say, tomorrow I am going to Istanbul. After the little boy's body got washed up on the sand, Australia offered synthetic duvets, fake chai lattes, and empty promises to the 12,000 of the 5 million in camps who cry themselves to sleep at night. And I have calculated this on my iPhone, and it works out to be a teardrop in the ocean to the closest decimal point. Australia, I have offered more hope to more cockatoos, more safety to kookaburras, more gum leaves to koalas than the crumbs you are flicking from your all-you-can-eat buffet. It is time to feed the birds, Australia. Tuppence a fucking bag. Sure, what does it cost to pipe in a haggis, share some tatties and neeps, raise a glass to their health? Mia Council Casa is to Council Casa. Australia, the world's eyes are rolling in your general direction, and right now you look like some kind of Jesus-sandaled arsehole sitting on the veranda of your oceanfront property with your deep pockets and short arms, pretending you don't even know it's your turn to buy the next round at the bar. Thank you. I might just ask
Just for a quick show of hands for anyone in the audience who's ever had an affair. Okay. Okay, so not just me then. So not just me then. So I often think that the word affair, the definition of the word affair should include a line which says, we'll end badly. I've never heard of any that end well, do they? Mine didn't. So this is called fridge poetry. Those little magnet things you stick on the fridge. Then there was the bangle on your table when you came back from Hong Kong, left behind by one of the others, I assumed, the Chinese one, perhaps, who makes the best Sichuan prawns in Sydney, and I can barely boil an egg. And on my birthday, you bought me fridge poetry magnets and a card which, when opened, burped. And the message inside read, happy burp day. You thought I didn't laugh because I didn't get it. That same day I told you I didn't want to see you again, not because of the card. There were other things much worse than the card. You looked surprised. Your shoulders slumped. You arranged your best devastated frown, hung your head the way a dog might do when there are no more bones. Oh, Ali, you said. And from a certain angle, I thought you may actually have meant it, though you'd been in film for years. You knew how to make fiction appear real. I drove 21 kilometers that day to a town I did not know, dropped the bangle and the burp card in a wheelie bin outside a chicken shop selling spicy wingdings, medium chips, cans of Schweppes, and sometimes in my lighter moments I think back. Imagine the owner of that bin opening the lid and the burps ringing out far across the land. The fridge poetry magnets went in that bin too, though not until I'd stuck cunt, fuckwit, and arsehole on my refrigerator door. Subject of infidelity and those sorts of things. Has anyone in the audience ever had couples therapy? Oh, good. Okay.
Me too, but the other part of the couple didn't continue with it.
Oh, is that all right? It's over. Okay.
I've just had singles therapy.
Well, this is about couples therapy. This is called, what's wrong with my throat? The shit we are in. No more, no less than anyone else. We found this guy, couples therapist, tri-level terrace in Paddington, handy for coffee afterwards in one of those groovy cafes. He came down to the waiting room to meet us. He says, Ali and John, I said, it's Ali and Thomas. Oh, he says, are we here to talk about someone called John? And snickered wheezily like Muttley from Wacky Races, we rolled our eyes. Followed him to his office. He was Italian, reminded us of a toad, with his facial warts, swollen throat, mouth a horizontal line like Kermit, and yes, I have been known to confuse my amphibians. He tells us he listens to his patients 70% of the time. The other 30, he said, he'd be thinking about other things like dinner, his girlfriend, ballroom dancing. And when he wasn't thinking about dinner, his girlfriend, ballroom dancing, he made us sit in chairs opposite each other, like porcelain figurines, instructed us to hold hands, look into each other's eyes, and take the whole fucking thing seriously. His fee was $320.
Thomas rustled chewing gum packets, clicked his pen incessantly. I threw him daggers he could not see. He is legally blind. And while we sat opposite each other like porcelain figurines, we had to say shit like, Thomas, last week when I asked you to clean the leak for soup and you didn't do it, I was hurt. Then Thomas was meant to say shit like, I'm sorry I hurt you. It was unkind of me to promise to clean the leak and then not do it. Only by this time, Thomas and I both laughing our tits off because it's absurd. Then the dog tells us if we think it's funny, then how about this is the last session? Only he was raging. You could tell by the way his throat ballooned in and out. So we said, fine, paid our bill, left, walked towards Oxford Street to the groovy cafes, united in our, did we just get fired from therapy, sort of outrage. We held hands voluntarily. The sun was setting. It was a gentle night. Heat had seared all day. The man on the news said someone out west fried an egg on a shovel. And then this breeze came from somewhere. Bondi, maybe Clovelly, wrapped itself around us. We stopped under a street lamp, snogged unexpectedly. He lit a gitan. Girls with legs skinny as spaghetti in jeans walked past. In all honesty, we are nowhere near groovy enough for this town. We found a cafe, dimly lit, tucked ourselves in, ordered our decafs. Caffeine and proximity to bedtime is an equation we simply must consider these days. The waiter with the garland of roses in his hair delivered the decafs. We sipped on them. Thomas said, sorry about the leak. I said, don't worry about it. It's just a fucking leak. And I scraped the chocolatey froth from inside my cup. Then we headed to the car. Thomas lit another fag. Mind if I smoke in the car, he asked. Knock yourself out, I said. He rolled down the windows. Turned on the air, the car filled and swirled in thick blue smoke as we drove into the night and never looked back. Thank you. So we are still married. This next poem that I'm going to read is a poem which examines my own unconscious, very unconscious prejudices at a time where there was nothing, the news was constantly bombarding us with these awful negative images of Muslims and Islam. So, yeah, that's what this poem is. It takes place in a part of Sydney where I go to write. In this cafe. Please do not pee in the sink. In the cafe with the coffee cups for lampshades and the sign that says please do not pee in the sink, we take an outside table. We have been coming here for years. We consider this table to be ours. Today there is an unexpected madman at the table next to us. He is leaping to his feet every 5 minutes, kneeling in the middle of the footpath and praying to Allah. I tell my husband I think we should go, that the praying man in the unfashionable blouson is, I will confess, scaring me a little. My husband tells me I'm being ridiculous, like 4 years ago when the spider lay in wait for me in the toilet and he had to remove it before I could pee. And every time since I have gone, I take a torch, scan the front and back of the door, the inside of the toilet roll tubes and under the wicker basket where I keep the Earth Choice toilet cleanser and the eco-friendly air freshener. We always bring our dog to this cafe. The internet tells us Muslims do not like dogs. They make their prayers impure.
It is their version of us peeing in the sink. Our coffees have no sooner arrived till the unexpected madman is down on his knees again, and I leak involuntary squeals like air escaping from the mouth of an overinflated balloon, and my imagination, made fertile by too frequent watering, convinces me his unfashionable blouson is packed with explosives. And post-detonation, there'll be skimmed cappuccino froth and body parts scattered the length of Bleak Point Road. In all the years we've been coming here, the daily special has never changed. Something about fettuccine in a mushroom sauce with pesto and a hint of Dijon. Not Dijon mustard, just Dijon, as though the chef might wear a French beret and cycle to work with a string of onions hanging off the handlebars of his bicyclette. Next time we came to the cafe, the unexpected madman was there. And the time after that, and the time after that, and every 5 minutes he'd be down on his knees. Months passed like this, days drifted. We kept coming, he kept praying, nothing exploded. Eventually we came to enjoy watching mothers with strollers wide berth him, and dog walkers drag reluctant puppies to the other side of the road. Then one day he rose, made eye contact, pointed at our dog, said, "Your dog very big." We nodded, he smiled. Next time we came, he offered his hand, we shook it. Bought him coffee, shared our fags. Months passed like this, days drifted. Sometimes when I'd come alone, he'd ask, "Where is husband?" I tell him he's at work, buy him a coffee. He'd point at Hector, "Your dog very big." More months passed like this, more days drifted. One day he tells me he is looking for a job, asks me for $2, I give him $5. In his country, he is accountant. His English skills are poor. I worry how he will manage. I've taken to minding his stuff while he's down on his knees. I make sure no one touches his unfashionable blouson, his lighter, his fags, his Yale lock key. Yesterday when I arrived, he wasn't there. I looked up Leap Point Road, saw him in the distance, walking towards the cafe, hair combed, high-vis vest, working boots. He stopped at my table, pressed a crumpled $5 note into my palm, cupped his hands warmly around mine. "For you," he said, "I have job now." And he smiled his charming Middle Eastern smile, pointed at Hector. "Your dog very big," he said. I couldn't have agreed more. Thank you. Another kind of scathing affair poem. This is the same affair, I must add. Single ply toilet paper. I think I liked things better when you were checking yourself into emergency departments with panic attacks brought on, you said, from being too far away from me. I even preferred things when you thought you had bladder cancer with weeks to live. We grew close those 7 days. You washed my clothes for me, referred to the other side of your bed as mine, ordered the sizzling tofu ahead of my arrival at the Lucky Red Dragon on the main street. It was January. We found a cottage by the sea, spent 4 days there together, shopped at the grocery store in the village. You carried the basket with one hand, held mine with the other, bought Irish soda scones, long life soy milk, single ply toilet paper. If your tumour cleared up, you were leaving for Cairo in February. 8 months of filming in the Sahara. You asked if I would join you, and I said yes. And after Cairo, you'd be leaving for LA, 2 months of filming in the Mojave Desert, and you asked if I would join you, and I said yes. And when your tumor disappeared, and you prepared to leave for Cairo without me, I will not lie, it was difficult to wish you well. In fact, I wished you'd die horribly, say in a light plane crash in the Sahara, or by gunshot wound in LA, and the ship carrying your equipment and 6 months of supplies would sink tragically off the Costa de la Muerte, where your long life soy milk would spoil, your single-ply toilet paper turned to mush, and shoals of gilt-headed bream would swim curiously through your pile of drowning camera parts, glance briefly into your lens before darting in the opposite direction as fast as their fins could carry them. Thank you. I just started writing poetry about maybe 5 years ago now, but I was one of those people who said they hated poetry up until that point in time, and I sort of stumbled on it quite accidentally, and then I started writing it. And this poem speaks a little bit to that, because whenever anybody asks me what I'm writing now, my first book was a memoir, but they ask me what I'm writing now, and I tell them poetry, and they do glaze over a little bit. That has to be said. If you write poetry but do not like conversation, what you can do is you can tell people at parties that you write poetry. And what that means is the people at the parties will not know what to say to you. If they do say something, mostly it will be that they do not like poetry. But because you're at a party, you must make conversation. So you will say to them, to not like poetry is to say you do not like one of your ears, or your right kidney, or seeing the frost curl and rise at dawn to lick the world silver. Sometimes, when you tell people you write poetry, what they will understand is that you stare out of the window for too many hours and wear a cravat and smoke cigarettes in a long cigarette holder, and that you do not do anything of any real value because you do not earn any money from doing this thing. What they will also understand is because you write poetry, you must be a poet, but they will not understand the act of writing poetry does not necessarily make you a poet. If you try to explain this to them, they will have to excuse themselves and go to the kitchen to top up their sparkling Lambruscos because they think it is champagne. Then the next person who comes along will also ask you what you do, and you will say the poetry thing again, and they will ask you why you write poetry. And you will say, because Scottish heather flourishes in the harshest of spots, like the cracks of rocks where there's no love and still it survives. And they will not know what you are talking about and will think that sometimes you wear smocks and puffy sleeves and only ever write things about tulip petals and emerald fields and newborn lambs, etc. And sometimes they will ask you how long it takes to write a poem, and you will tell them 1 week or 52, it depends. And the waiter will come around with a platter of vol-au-vents and the blinis topped with smoked salmon and an inch of creme fraiche, with the sprig of green dill planted like a baby Christmas tree knee deep in snow. And this will be the perfect moment for them to move away to the kitchen and top up their sparkling too. And finally, you will be left alone, although you're never really alone, because you will always have your bag filled with the notebooks and the backs of napkins and the gaggles of pens. And when the party is over, your notes will say things like, number one, Google Bellini ingredients. Number two, sparkling Lambrusco is not champagne.
Number three, writing poetry does not make you a poet any more than not killing an ant will make you a Buddhist, and you will be satisfied you went to the party and that you tried to make conversation, but you decide you will not go to the parties of the future, and you will not hate the people for not loving poetry in the way that you love it. Sure, there was a time you hated poetry too. Thank you. So this is the last poem that I will read, and this I'm finishing on a bit of death again. But when I got back to Australia after my father died, so many people said to me, "Oh my God, it was so unreal that you were there when it happened, as if it was meant to be," you know. And I don't subscribe to that at all, because I'd been to Scotland before that, and you know, nothing drastic happened. This is Duty Free Fags. And after he died, they, people, customers of mine said, "How strange to have been there. Like it was meant to be that I would touch down in Glasgow at that precise time." And it was like they were saying the universe or God or something had planned it that way. And I said to them, "I also came home 3 years ago. I saw Lochs the colour of a Dulux sample card, crossed the Sound of Sleet to the Isle of Skye, ate Cullen's skink at Cafe Gandolfi, and nobody died. Nor the time before, when my brother and I hiked through the Fairy Glen, lost our footing and tumbled down the Old Man of Stour, carving a trench with our arses. We landed in a heap, one on top of the other, astonishing sheep, laughed so hard I turned the snow yellow around us. And I have not many kin left in Scotland now, and it is not that they have died. We have merely drifted, as snow might drift on Rannoch Moor in the thick of winter January's. Time will do this, and distance. And these days I do not forewarn with airline itineraries, nor details of stopovers in exotic locations. I keep secret my timing of tumbles and Cullen skinks, that I might save my kin, the wringing of hands and pacing of midnight floors, that they may remain blissfully unaware of my arrival into Glasgow with my duty-free fags and my kiss of death." Thank you so much.